Arts organizations seek clarity in an era when money promised isn't always delivered. From SDPB, today is Monday, June 23rd. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we'll look at the economic impact of arts organizations in the state, and we'll talk about how federal spending cuts are impacting payment of work already completed. Jim Spears is with us. Then we will get to know a small business owner who is closing up shop to make a home somewhere his family feels safe outside of South Dakota. Plus, we meet the creative professionals behind a new movie set in Gregory County. The film Fall is a Good Time to Die is available to stream now. Dalton Coffey, Abby Coffey, and Joe Hyatt join us later in the hour. We are broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're In the Moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. South Dakotans across the state are navigating an era of unpredictable cuts in government spending. And that includes clawbacks of money already promised for work that might already have been done. Arts organizations are taking hits from these unprecedented mid-fiscal year cuts. Jim Spears is Executive Director of Arts South Dakota. He joined me in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio to discuss the challenges.
I think the disruption in the normal process, unprecedented disruption, and pulling of funding, current funding that has been essentially contracted and promised to arts organizations in the state is very troubling to me. I think most of your listeners will know about the 83% cut to the National Endowment for the Humanities that happened about a couple months ago. That pretty much shuttered that agency, pretty much shut it down. And it also meant that all of the funding, current funding, funding that was in process, essentially, to the South Dakota Humanities Council was also stopped. So they just quit receiving their federal funding, their federal payments, which is about 70% of their budget. And so therefore, this is the trickle down. Therefore, they had to stop funding their grants.
Right.
And so you see organizations in the state that are already operating right up to the line. I mean, arts organizations are not known for being cash flush or, you know, we operate on most of the time as a fairly bare bones budget, very efficient. I think most arts nonprofits are known for being very efficient. And so you have these organizations that are in the middle of programming, in the middle of this fiscal year, doing work that they budgeted for with funds from the federal government, that all of a sudden, mid-year, they're being told, well, you're not going to get this $30,000 grant.
Right.
So if you're an organization in Eagle Butte, South Dakota, and you're about ready to put on a big project here, you know, in the July, and in April you're told you're not going to get $30,000 towards the budget of that project, how do you replace that in a couple months? What do you do?
Right.
This is work that has already been done, payments that have already been made. People maybe don't understand that these National Endowment for the Arts and Humanities grants are reimbursement grants. So you don't get your funding till after your work is done.
Okay.
And so then you have the federal government saying, well, I guess we're not going to fund you now after you've done the work. So to me, that's the most troubling development here this year. You know, we can talk about appropriations. We can talk about next fiscal year. We can talk about budgets and advocating for voting for certain programs. But when the program has already been funded by Congress and then the administration decides they're going to pull all that back, I just don't know how nonprofits can operate securely in that environment.
Yeah.
It's virtually impossible.
How many people are you hearing from in South Dakota that this is impacting right now?
Well, we're hearing from four or five notable organizations in the state that have learned that funding in place, contracts, grants in place have been rescinded. And so, you know, there's then that trickles down. These are organizations that then pay artists, that then pay contractors within their communities for the work being done on these projects. So, I mean, it affects hundreds of people and livelihoods of hundreds of people, if not more.
Yeah. How are they responding?
I think there's a lot of confusion. Well, for example, the National Endowment for the Humanities, you know, that agency was cut by 83%, virtually closing the agency. And so you have grantees that have been told, you're not going to get this grant, but here's the process for challenging that, you know.
Sure, right.
But then when you try to call the office to to make the challenge, to ask how to argue your case, you can't get anybody. So you're virtually just locked out of it. You know, you're sort of floundering. You're just sort of on your own. Mm-hmm. So I think we don't know really what to do. I think these organizations are trying to reach representatives at these agencies. They're not getting through. There's no word on, you know, if they've submitted a challenge, how long it will take, what that looks like, when would they get funding, if it would eventually be approved. Who do you talk to? So it's just almost like you're just sort of left out in the open on your own to figure it out. As you and I were talking before we went on here today, you know, I believe that artists will always find a way. Creativity will always thrive. There's no doubt about that. I'm disappointed in the lack of support from our government leaders, because we know how important the arts are to strong communities, to well-rounded education, to business in our on
right.
our main streets.
Right. Economic development.
Yeah, economic development.
If you don't have that play,
right?
Then you don't have people coming downtown for the play.
Yep.
You don't have people buying dinner for the pre-show dinner.
Exactly.
Going out afterwards for a drink. There's just lots of things that you don't, stopping at the local boutique on the way home. There's
yeah.
just lots of things that you don't have because the show didn't go on.
Exactly. I mean, it's an entire economic activity that's generating local business, right? And I think there's great numbers to share, and we've shared these on the show before, but arts nonprofit organizations in South Dakota generate $360 million a year in economic activity,
mm-hmm.
Supporting over 6,000 full-time jobs in our state, and they generate $51 million annually in federal, local, and state taxes.
Mm-hmm.
Those nonprofits are supported in large part by the South Dakota Arts Council, which is also in turn supported by the National Endowment for the Arts. So when we talk about the importance of the National Endowment for the Arts and federal funding, that support really is the seed. That's the initial investment that spurs all of this economic activity.
Yeah.
The National Endowment really only supports, South Dakota Arts Council only supports nonprofits. So this data I'm sharing today is a direct result from those that support from state and national funding. And then I'll just say nationally, the same study looked at economic activity by arts nonprofits nationally, Lori, at $151 billion nationally. Over 2.5 million full-time jobs are supported in the arts nonprofit industry in the United States, and over $29 billion in federal, state, and local taxes are generated. So you look at $207 million National Endowment for the Arts budget for FY25, our current fiscal year, and you look at the economic activity that investment spurs within our country.
Right.
It's to me, it's a no-brainer, and that's just the economic argument, which is not the most important thing when we're talking about arts and creativity, but it is a very real factor.
Yeah, we're more divided than ever in this country, and we have some statistics to talk about that as well.
I learned these when I was in D.C. a few months ago at an Americans for the Arts meeting. 94% of Americans believe there's a growing division or lack of unity in our country. That's mm-hmm. about as unified a voice that you'll hear in this country. 94%, that's virtually everyone. So
we all agree that we don't agree.
Yeah, we all agree that we don't agree.
We all agree that there's growing discontent
that's
and
right.
disagreement. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. And so then we look at some of the statistics related to the arts. 72% of Americans believe the arts create opportunity for shared experiences. 70% believe the arts create a safe space for conversation. 63% of Americans believe the arts help us understand other cultures in our community. And 81% of Americans believe the arts provide a positive experience in a troubled world. So when you talk about growing division and lack of unity, how do we solve that? How do we create unity? How do we create a sense of community? I think you do it through the arts.
That's Jim Spears, Executive Director of Arts South Dakota, discussing the impacts of federal arts funding cuts. Find more information at artssouthdakota.org. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Mike Phelan is owner of Outside of a Dog Books and Games in Vermilion. The small business opened more than 3 years ago, and Phelan says he will close or sell the store within the next 2 months. Now, his family is leaving the community and the state because of anti-LGBTQ laws recently passed in South Dakota. We connected with him from SDPB studios at the University of South Dakota's campus in Vermilion. You are the proprietor or owner of one of my favorite small businesses in South Dakota because I love to check out independent bookstores wherever I go, and you run Outside of a Dog in Vermilion. Tell me a little bit about the shop.
We opened Outside of a Dog Books and Games 3.5 years ago down here in Vermilion. I never had any inclination to open a business before this. I was a teacher, various different levels, for 15 years. We moved to Vermilion in 2020, and you know, my wife must have said 20 times over the years, "You should start a bookstore. Why don't you start a bookstore?" Yeah. And she said it again that fall. And always in the past, I had been doing something else. I had a job. I was in grad school, and it was, "Oh yeah, that'd be fun." But she said it again that year, and it really clicked with me. And Vermilion is a great college town, and at the time, it didn't have a bookstore. A college town
shocking.
Without a bookstore.
Yeah.
It really felt like it was missing something. Yeah. So we opened our doors in November 2021 and have been going strong ever since.
Yeah. For people who don't know, Outside of a Dog, from a Groucho Marx line, fairly famous, which is...
Outside of a dog, a book is man's best friend. Inside of a dog, it's too dark to read.
I love that one.
So it gave us kind of instant theming to do everything dog-related. Our dog, Waldo, is at the shop every day and is kind of a celebrity around town.
Yeah. What were some of the, the business climate in Vermilion when you opened it? Did you find that people were supportive of there being an independent bookstore in this digital age?
Extremely. Yeah. So when I first started the idea, I thought, hey, didn't Amazon kill all the indie bookstores? And spent, 6 months, 8 months doing research, and no, independent bookstores really have bounced back. More are opening than closing every year since, I think, 2010. And Vermilion specifically was fantastic about helping us figure out how to do it and getting us excited about it. We were still pretty new in town, went to a party with friends of friends, and had people coming up to me, "Hey, are you the guy who's thinking about starting a bookstore? Oh, you should really do that. I would love to see this kind of thing." We did a online crowdfunding campaign to help start the store. And we knew that, our friends and family around the country would kick in a little bit where they could. But when we started to get donations from people in Vermilion that we didn't already know who were excited about the store, that was a real sign to us that there was something happening here.
Yeah. And games. Board games.
And games as well. Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about why adding games and what sort of appetite you found for people who wanted to sit and play either an old-fashioned board game like Scrabble or one of the newer role-playing games that you stocked in the store.
Yeah, we do all kinds of games as well, from quick card games that you can play with young kids to deep strategy games that you can sit around with your friends every Sunday for 6 months and run through campaigns. And from a business point of view, it gave us a second reason for people to come into the store. So not everybody is a reader, but we wanted more people to come into the store. And so it's a reason to bring more people in. It gives us events. We run game nights, Saturday nights, where you can come try out a new game. We'll teach you how to play, and you can get a discount if you buy it that night. And we've had great responses. It's been fun to see everybody from, high school kids to retirees all coming together and playing together.
How did people either... during the pandemic, because you start this in 2021, coming out of that, there must have been a longing or an appetite for that kind of connectivity. Did people discover new things about reading and connecting via games and books that maybe was solidified in the pandemic? Or was it the opposite, where you had to educate people and help them figure out this world that they could possibly enter into?
Yeah, I think people were hungry for that connection again. I know we certainly were. So our events that first year were very well attended. Still get good attendance now, but kind of right from the get-go, people looking for ways to get out, to do things that were social but maybe didn't like risk quite as much that they might otherwise.
Yeah.
So we're putting on an event, and we had a lot of feedback that it was nice to have something that wasn't just going to the bar, right?
Right, yeah.
And where you could do all ages together. Not to put down bars, we have great bars and restaurants here in Vermilion, but people are looking for another option.
Yeah.
So we've had well-attended book clubs. We have, we just had our Sword Modern Fiction book club last night, which has been one of my very favorite things. That's been going strong almost since the beginning of the store. We've now got 4 different book clubs that we run that have great attendance and great discussions, and where we read and talk about things that people wouldn't have found on their own.
Yeah. Well, the last time I was there, I cleaned out your George Saunders section and was deep into short stories, because that's something I'm interested in right now particularly. And so I come back and I tell my coworkers, you know, what I found at Outside of a Dog. And they'll tell me when they're down in Vermilion. Of course, we have many SDPP folks who work in Vermilion. And then someone said they're closing. And we were wondering why, because surely we have helped you become successful.
We have been successful through our patronage.
And yep. So you're shutting down when and for what reasons?
Yeah, unfortunately, we will be closing or selling the store sometime this summer because of the anti-LGBTQ laws passed in South Dakota. Those are laws that really personally affect our family.
Mm-hmm.
We've lobbied hard against them. We've joined support groups and worked with groups all across the state and the broader region to try to stop these bills, to mitigate their effects when we couldn't stop them. But the focus on othering or trying to eliminate transgender people from public life in South Dakota particularly is driving us out of the state. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, we're not the only ones.
Would you say it's a codifying discrimination?
It absolutely is. We know that transgender people are regular human people. They want all the same things. They need all the same things. To try and put this very small minority of people who are just being asked to live their lives in peace,
mm-hmm.
As such a focus for, you know, pretend problems. There's not a crime wave of transgender people, you know, doing anything but existing in our state. Or in our country. But we've seen it happen nationally and here in South Dakota. It's been, I think, 10 out of the last 11 years, there have been one or more bills introduced in the South Dakota legislature specifically attacking transgender people.
Mm-hmm.
And that is exhausting and disheartening.
And it's time to go to to that point where you and your wife started looking for jobs outside the state.
Yes. When we came in 2020, mm-hmm. We moved from Chicago.
Okay.
And at that point, there had been some bills introduced, but the South Dakota legislature had not passed those, or the governor had vetoed them.
Mm-hmm.
Like right at the time that we were making that decision in February, March, the legislature had defeated the anti-trans healthcare bill that mm-hmm. year. A bathroom bill had been defeated. And we thought, okay, well, maybe, you know, there's more open-mindedness. Maybe it is a different kind of conservatism. You know, we had no illusions that, you know, what the political situation was. But we kept hearing, okay, it's a different kind of conservatism. And people who talk about local control, we looked at Vermilion and we thought, well, here's a city that we fit in very much. We have loved Vermilion. We've made positive impacts, I think, in a lot of ways in Vermilion. But as soon as some of those issues became more nationally prevalent, those attacks on transgender people became more incessant. And even when Vermilion passed a positive policy, immediately there was a state bill introduced to knock it back down.
So as a father of transgender child, there are some things in South Dakota that your child is not allowed to do. And then as we see, you know, a recent Supreme Court decision upholding a ban of healthcare in Tennessee, there are, you know, nationally also President Donald Trump has removed the siloing of, you know, when you call 988, you can push one. If you're a veteran, you can push a number. If you were looking for counselors who were specializing in LGBTQ care, and he's trying to eliminate that or has eliminated that. So there are things that the reality in this country right now is that your child might not be able to use the bathroom the kid wants to use, might not be able to get a passport someday, might not be able to join the military, might not be able to join a sports team, might not be able to get the health care that you as a parent feel with your doctor fits your child's needs. How do you... And there are nuances to all of those, so I know I'm putting them out there as very broad brushes right here. But my point is that you have different things that you have to consider for your kid than many other parents have to consider for theirs. How do you navigate that as parents, especially with younger children, to communicate in your family about when your kid says, when I grow up, I want to do this, you might have to say, I'm not sure if they can.
It's tough. We know that these are things that are happening at the state level and at the national level. But the one thing I emphasize with this is 99.9% of my life as a parent has nothing to do with my kid being transgender, right? Most of my parenting battles are eat your vegetables, clean your room, go to sleep at a reasonable time. And the, you know, the additional things that we have to think about with having a transgender kid are normally things that shouldn't be anybody else's problem. It shouldn't be anybody else's issue, not anybody else's business. My kid needs a little different medical care than your kid or the neighbor's kid. That's fine. That's something that under normal circumstances, my doctor can take care of with, or my, you know, my kid's doctor can take care of with them. And when we see these kinds of bills passed or these kinds of, you know, national focus on things that are a non-issue for everybody else, it just makes everything else kind of focus in on that one issue. My kids are young, they're 9 and 12. They know what's going on in the world. They're probably more aware of how state political systems run than the majority of other kids in the world, in the country. And they do pay some attention, but mostly they're busy being kids, you know, playing in the community theater or playing baseball, things like that. For us as parents, my number one job, my wife's number one job, we've always told our kids, our number one job is to keep you safe, to help you grow up and to be kind and productive humans, but number one, to keep you safe. And that's where this gets harder. We know when our kid first came out as transgender, we researched as much as we could. And the first thing that we saw was that transgender kids who don't have support from the adults in their life, who don't have support from their parents, who don't have support at school, who don't have support from their community, the suicide rate is 10 to 15 times higher than it is for cisgender kids.
Wow.
15 times higher, 10 times higher. And if the kids, if transgender kids have support, if they have support at home, if they have support at school, if they have support in their community, that goes right back down to baseline. It's not about being transgender. It's about being transgender in a place where everybody around you is coming for you all the time, tells you that you're wrong and you're different. And we know that that is our number one job, is to keep our kids safe.
Wrong and different is a hard way to grow up.
It is. So I think if I can have any message from this, it's to talk to you know, let transgender people across South Dakota know that you're not alone, you're not wrong, you're not badly made. We're just dealing with a tough time in our state legislature. There is support out there, and there are more supportive places that you can be if you can get yourself there.
What does dignity mean for your family? What does freedom mean for your family? What does justice mean for your family right now? When I throw those ideas at you, what does that bring up for you?
Oh, man. You know, we see in South Dakota and nationally a lot of messaging from, I'll say, all sides on political issues about parents' rights. We see a lot of messaging about small government, about local control. And that lasts just as long as a parent isn't trying to exercise rights on behalf of a transgender kid. My kid isn't trying to grow up to convert the world to be transgender. I didn't talk my kid into being transgender. I didn't put pressure on my kid to be transgender. You know, if I could talk my kid into something, it would be finishing dinner in a reasonable amount of time and cleaning her room every now and then. I think I'm a pretty decent parent, but I struggle with talking a kid into that. You think I can talk a kid into changing their gender? No. What does dignity, what does justice mean? That's even hard to think about right now, where we're in a position that it's almost, you know, survival. I'm not worried about coming out of it with dignity. I'm not worried about coming out of it with justice at the moment. I'm worried about my kid growing up and making it to adulthood.
Well, it is my privilege to sit with you in this space and just tell the unvarnished truth about what this is like. And you're telling us that we're getting a sliver of a peek into your family's life. And I really just want to thank you for sharing that with the people of South Dakota, as I know that's not easy to do. It might be easier to pack a bag and kick the dust off your boots when you leave.
Yeah, it breaks our heart, honestly. But our family has loved Vermilion. This is a wonderful community in so, so many ways. We have gotten more involved here than any place else we've ever lived. Mm. We feel tighter connection to our community here than any place else we've ever lived. We wanted this to be the place that we, you know, grew old, that our family called home for a generation. And we're really heartbroken that it can't be. Our business isn't the first to have to close. We aren't the first people to have to feel kind of driven out of the state by these. We've had friends in Vermilion last year, in Sioux Falls this spring, who have just said, we fought all that we can fight, and now we have to put our family's health and safety first.
What is your message for people who are staying in this state going forward? Are there ways that you would advise allies, people who do feel safe staying here, to do the work that you believe needs to be done politically to help people understand this issue more fully?
Tell your story where it's safe. I don't have huge hopes for our state legislature in anything like the near term in terms of making good choices. You know, I think most of our legislators know that these are distraction issues, but they're fine to run on them. They won't pay a political price in their part of South Dakota. So for transgender people who are in South Dakota, the only message that I have is that you are worthwhile, you are valid, and there is community that loves you. Mm. For people who are allies of the trans community, please speak up, please share stories, don't share names, don't share identifying details if you don't have to. But let the people in your community know that, let the trans people in your community know that you love them. Let the rest of your community know that this is an issue that's important to you. Because it's not, you know, we're not out here trying to overhaul the whole system. We're not out here trying to force things upon anyone. We're just trying to raise our kids with ways that, you know, what our doctors say is the best way. Mm-hmm. What our kids and our friends and our neighbors are telling us are the, you know, when somebody tells you this is who I am as a human being, listen to them.
Well, thank you for the books. Thank you for thank Waldo for the pets. Thank you for spending time with us here today. And I hope every listener hears those words and knows we see you, we hear you, you have dignity, you have value. You are South Dakotan.
I appreciate that. And thank you for the opportunity to talk about this. And thank you for sharing stories with us at the bookstore.
Yeah.
We do hope the store can continue on after we're gone. I think all the ways that we can share these stories are important.
Yeah. Go hug your kids. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
Mike Phelan is owner of Outside of a Dog, Books and Games in Vermilion. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm your host, Lori Walsh. It is an independent film set in South Dakota, filmed in South Dakota, and with a distinct South Dakota feel. Fall is a Good Time to Die is a revenge thriller largely shot in Gregory County. Filmmaker Dalton Coffey directs Fall is a Good Time to Die. Joe Hyatt is the star of the show. Abby Coffey is co-owner with Dalton of the production company behind the movie. She produced the film. And the three of them stepped into SDPB's Kirby Family Studio to talk about the film's distribution. So I'm happy to have all three of you together. We were all together at the State Theater for a very full house of moviegoers, and we did a Q&A up front. And then when we were done, we said, we got to do this for the rest of South Dakota since everybody can see this film now. So Dalton, for people who don't remember, didn't hear the last conversation and haven't watched the film yet, how do you pitch Fall is a Good Time to Die?
It's a gritty revenge story that is, I think, kind of, I think it's slightly different take on a revenge story.
Yeah.
It's a little bit more moody, and I'd say there's just a lot more space, a lot more thought-provoking.
Yeah. Filmed and made and produced in South Dakota, Gregory County.
Well, it seems like every time somebody comes here to make a film, whether they make films here or outside, especially if they come in from out of state and make films, they always go to the Badlands or... Yeah. You know, out west like that, and that's obviously fascinating. But there are a lot of other sort of geographical interesting places in this state, and the Missouri River Hills near Gregory County was one that I always thought was really pretty. And I go there a lot because Abby's from there, mm-hmm. and her family still, or at least she got a grandmother and lots of family that still live out there. And when we were looking to do this, we thought that seemed like a great place that seemed like it hadn't really been captured yet.
Yeah.
And one of the hardest things to do is to try to capture something honestly, because film is a great way to make something look like it isn't.
Mm.
It almost seems easier to make, you know, something that you go, well, that's not what that actually looks like. It's like
right.
meeting actors in person and go, oh, you look different on screen. And so there was kind of a challenge to try to capture it well and correctly, but that was definitely a big draw, was to do something not a lot of people have done necessarily.
Mm-hmm. But Abby, you're out, you're scouting locations, you're scouting pickup trucks, you're trying to find people to be in the background. Tell me a little bit about how you brought your home to the big screen.
Yeah, it was really fun, actually, when we decided to do this in South Dakota. It was one of those things that I was like, okay, we can go home and I think people will embrace us, because mm-hmm. that's kind of a big thing with film, right? Like, people are either really all in or they're really all out. There's no middle ground, and we don't ever like to convince people to do something.
Yeah.
So I start with Dalton, and I usually say, what do you need? What are you looking for? What is in your head? And he tells me I need to pick up. And then I just, honestly, I just started looking through Facebook and looking at pictures of my family's things at home and parades and showing him, do you like this one? Do you like this one? Other areas that we knew were beautiful because the River Hills are just gorgeous out there. And so looking for some of those spaces that you see that are very unique, actually, where kind of the main action takes place in the film, that was actually found kind of late in the game. But you don't, people don't know where that is. They won't know, even from home. There will be a lot of people who won't know.
Like, where
what
is that
is.
Spot? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They're going to be like, where did you find that? So so it's kind of fun to just drive around, drive the back roads, go to the family farms, you know, talk with people, see if they were interested and willing to help us. Same thing with people. I would ask Dalton, like, who's in your head? Who are you picturing? At one point, he actually said, your cousin Brittany is in my mind, and I not for any like reason. I don't want her to feel bad that I'm picturing her in this role. Or so some of those questions were the hardest when you're trying to convince your cousin, would you be someone who's maybe interested in little kids? That's not a fun question to ask your cousin.
But. Right, because we should outline the plot a little bit. This is a revenge story. Cody is a farmhand, and his sister is missing, or something bad has happened to his sister. We learn at the beginning of the film, and she was quite young. And so the person who committed this crime is been released, and it's a long play out of a hunt that Cody is looking. And we don't know really what his intentions are, but we know that there's a lot happening there. So there's suspense and, like you said, gritty. And Joe Hyatt, you get to play Cody. And you've worked with Dalton before.
Yes.
And the two of you have a pretty great relationship on camera and behind the scenes. Tell me what drew you to this project, other than the fact that you knew Dalton was in charge of it. But what about the character pulled you in?
I think from the beginning what I saw in Cody was this kid that didn't know how to talk about his feelings. He lacked a vocabulary to really release his feelings. And because of that, you know, he's living this lonely, isolated life. And because of that, I could just connect with him and really, like, have my heart break for him. And I think if you feel those things as an actor, you're sitting in a really good spot to be able to portray them.
He's kind of stuck in the past. Yeah. I mean, I said in the Q&A, there's an element of, in the narrative, that is sort of unstuck in time, which is what trauma does to people, but this character is kind of stuck in a certain place as well. And what was it like to film these, you know, long extended scenes in the sun, in the wind, in the rolling landscape of South Dakota?
Yeah, you know, like, I'm from South Dakota, and so I love telling stories about where I'm from. And when I think of, like, artists that I love and admire, they tell stories about where they're from. So I'm very proud telling this story, and I know the wind because I'm from here. And I know, even though I'm from, like, more of the city part of South Dakota, like, I'm from Sioux Falls, I have family that have farms, you know, and I feel like I also recognized this kid, and I had seen this kid before in my time, like, traveling across South Dakota. And, but, you know, like, I'm alone for a lot of this movie, and the land is kind of my scene partner for a lot of the scenes that I'm in. And what I loved about how we worked with the land is we didn't work around it, we worked with it. And so, like, if it was windy, that's what was happening in the scene. It wasn't like, oh, we need to stop and let this wind gust past. It was like, so it was something to play off of, too, which acting is reacting, so it was great. It was wonderful.
And Dalton, I love how you use the wind and the landscape are characters and scene partners. Like Joe said, that's beautiful, scene partner with the land. But then also you avoid all the cliches about it, because for people who make work here and then leave and go back to their places, and maybe they're not from South Dakota, we will often see, you know, the same kind of sunset, the Badlands, and descriptions of the wind that we all kind of, in journalism, at least, we always chuckle at, you know, a journalist who flew in from Rolling Stone, and then we said, well, you know, they tried to describe the wind. They were like, yeah, we knew you were going to put that in the first paragraph.
Of course.
But for you, it's very much part of the narrative as well. Tell me a little bit about working in the landscape for you as a filmmaker, which was challenging, frustrating, but also gave you a certain amount of freedom on the screen.
It definitely was challenging and frustrating in a lot of ways. I mean, Joe mentioned the wind, and There was a time when we got shut down because of the wind. Like, it just was too much. And we lost 2 days of shooting. 2 days in a row, actually. and nothing would stay still. The clothes were blowing around and looked ridiculous. His hat kept blowing off, and we duct taped it. We tried everything to keep it on his head. And the camera wouldn't stay still on the tri. It just was moving everything. We had to call that. But there were so many scenes that went right up against that, right up against the we almost can't be out here. And if you kind of lean into that, because that's what the character's got to go, this is real.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking when I was going into it that, oh, we'll be able to get a ton of footage. We'll just move over there and move over there. But over there is, you know, a quarter of a mile away.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to, and you don't really realize that. And you're, it's like you know it. And then you start to go, okay, everybody, let's rally everything up and move over there. And so you think, whoa, we'll get 8 or 10 shots. You might get 3.
Yeah.
And you're exhausted. And I think that, you know, as a filmmaker, your pursuit of something then kind of translates into his pursuit
mm-hmm.
as a character of something. If you just let it, just kind of go with it. And I love the sunsets and all that sort of stuff. And you know, obviously you mentioned that earlier in the prairie and the wind and stuff. Yeah. But there was, I don't know how many hundreds of tracks of wind are in this film. And
audio tracks,
it was,
yeah.
Yes. And yeah. I still swear at night, I still can hear the different frequencies, but they all meant something different. Mm-hmm. They all feel different when you hear the wind at this frequency versus this one, a higher pitched or a lower pitched.
Yeah.
And I paid attention to that when we were there.
Yeah.
And so when we were in the mixing suite, I tried to go, no, this is what it was like, or this is the tone that set for us that day. And we kind of rolled with it.
Yeah, that comes through so well on the film. I love what you said. Where I think anybody who works outside in ag, in construction, in anywhere can relate to that. We almost shouldn't be out here. That moment where you're like, should we be out here? We're almost going to have to shut it down. That is a constant decision for working in South Dakota in the weather. And when we're at the Q&A, people were asking questions, and again they talked about, you know, mending fences and what pickup trucks sound like. And I thought, when was the last time anybody was in a room with South Dakota filmmakers, South Dakota's on film, and the audience is South Dakotan, and everybody's talking about the trucks?
Yeah.
And that was a really great artistic moment for me as a journalist to be in that space and see how excited people were about how fence mending culture was depicted. Joe, can you mend a fence now?
Not very well. I know a little bit more. But
better than you could before you started making
exactly,
the film.
Exactly.
But it's important, Abby, for people to see themselves on the screen and not just on social media. Like, to see yourself on a screen in a professionally made film, to see your community depicted.
Yeah.
Is a big deal.
I think that's true. And that was one of the things that when Dalton and I talked about making a film in South Dakota, something that we always considered, I'm going to kind of call you out on this one, hon, but he always said, he's like, South Dakotans are kind of boring. Like, they're, you know, like we just kind of do life and we go mend fences and we drive our pickup trucks and we kind of try to avoid conflict when we can. And so I think Dalton did such a good job in writing this script to go, but there is stuff that happens here, and people deal with things maybe more internally than externally. And I want to show that. I want to show those kinds of life experiences that they end up having to heal from and deal with. And I think he pulled it off beautifully. Mm-hmm. And that was a fun thing to bring to my hometown. I mean, we made up the town that the bad guys in, because I couldn't make any of those towns. I couldn't take a town in South Dakota and make it the bad guy's place. So we made up that town and just kind of brought a bunch of little towns together to create it, you know? So there are things that we tried to do to kind of say, yeah, it's in South Dakota, but it's not.
Yeah. Right.
So there were little pieces, but I think you're right. People need to see themselves on the screen. And I think in the same way, as Joe had said, if you can connect with that actor, you can connect with that story and that character. There's just something to that. And I think there are different pieces in each one of these characters that I connect with. Even when I read it the first time, I'm like, man, these two women are so strong in who they are. That sheriff, that aunt, like, man, those are women I know out there.
Joe, tell me what it was like to work opposite the actors that you worked with, some of whom listeners might know from other projects.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a better actor because I've worked with them. You know, like, I learned so much from them, just like in terms of professionalism. You know, Joey Lauren Adams, it would have been so easy for her to just show up, do her one scene, and then go home. But she brought so much to that character. Yeah. And it made my job easier. And like, I respect them so much, so I was always nervous to work with them, but it was also such an education every time I got to, because I would tend to over prepare some scenes when I knew that we were going to be across from each other. And what they taught me was, no, it actually is more simple than you think, and it's really just about listening and reacting. That was huge for me, you know.
That's a great lesson for anybody who's wants to get into acting, is mm-hmm. you know, at its core, acting is listening and reacting to the other human being across from you.
Mm-hmm.
So what do we need to build out a community or an industry to create film jobs in the state so that the people who want to make these things can make them?
Yeah. I think that there's a number of things. I mean, we've talked before about how industry, there's kind of a lack of industry here for that.
Yeah.
Even if there's been talk before about tax incentives and things like that, and that's all fine and good. But even still, if a big production comes in here and decides they're going to make something, there's still the infrastructure's not here. They mm-hmm. can't. How are they going to handle transportation? How are they going to handle craft services? How are they going to handle location scouting, location managing, all of those things that are kind of inherent to where you're shooting? You need to have people that are kind of there doing that. Even casting, you need backgrounds. You need all of that. We don't have it. And until we have that kind of infrastructure, then the tax credits and all that.
So those are the artists themselves and the producers and the business people who are building this. So how, you know, Joe, you're early in your career. How do you build an infrastructure in your own community so that you have parts and that you are creating your own projects and that you have different options, but yet you can live and work mostly in South Dakota?
Another thing I learned from Joey and Jennifer is, like, being an actor now, you can kind of be anywhere because a lot of the auditions are online. But I think for me, the work starts before you get the job. Like, it doesn't start as soon as you get, like, cast in something. I mean, Sioux Falls is just, like, the theater scene here is so exciting right now. There are so many different things happening where you can go and work on your craft with talented people. And, you know, I need to take more advantage of that, too. But I think from the acting side of it, like, just get your reps in, kind of, and mm-hmm. be ready if an opportunity comes up.
Similarly, like with film, like production, I think that's kind of how I approach. We sort of both approach this, which we didn't really ask what's here, what can we do, what can we take advantage of. We just did it.
Mm-hmm.
We did. We kind of knocked on some doors, and it was very much like, well, I guess it's just sort of up to us. And there's the old term that pioneers get shot. And so I think, you know, we kind of developed this whole thing of don't be a pioneer, be an outlaw. When we went out into this, the state still feels very untamed in a lot of ways, artistically speaking. And obviously, the boots on the ground production stuff. And so I think we just need to, much like Joe's point, of just go and do it and don't ask for permission. I mean, obviously, you get permission to film places, but as cliche as that might sound, you just have to start doing that.
Go make some stuff with your friends.
Go make some stuff.
Absolutely.
Yes. And then
meet new people.
And try to and pursue excellence at every opportunity. And that's what I do. I constantly try to pursue excellence, and I'll never not do that. I'm pulled around by the nose. And even if it's just anything, it doesn't have to be film. It's just anything. If it's excellent, I'm drawn to it. Yeah. And so I want to constantly try my darndest to pursue that.
This film is excellent. You've definitely.
I have a lot to learn.
South Dakota Oscars. This is right up there. Where can people see it, Abby?
It currently is on Amazon, so we're going to send you there. You can buy or rent. I think people are going to want to buy this one because I think they're going to want a second viewing real quick.
Yeah.
Just a little tidbit. Buy it. Don't rent it. It's a pretty cheap way to support an artist.
Mm-hmm. It's like $7.
Yeah.
Writer and director Dalton Coffey, actor Joe Hyatt, producer Abby Coffey. The movie is called Fall is a Good Time to Die. It is available now. That's our show for today. We hope that it served you from all of us at SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.